We'll say in the clockwise direction. Under this map, you know, this circle is mapped to another circle of radius 1 of r, where the circle is being traversed in the counterclockwise direction. But what was inside this circle is now the outside, the circle. Okay? And therefore, it's actually orientation preserving. And the best way to see it is, of course, to see it on the Riemann sphere, of course, where the circle doesn't change under this map. Okay? And the Mobius groove of transformation that we wrote, remember, had this form. With the condition that AD minus BC cannot vanish. And here, if you choose A equals to 0, B equals to 1, D equals to 0, C equals to 1, you get the inversion. In today's tutorial, there'll be two tracks. One track will be for people who want to get experience doing contour integrals and solve some difficult integrals using Cauchy's residue theorem. And there'll be another track where you'll be asked to derive what is known as the Virasoro algebra. So those of you who have a lot of experience with contour integrals, you know, you're welcome to try the second optional problem. And there, you know, basically this will be one of the transformations of the Virasoro algebra. All right, so last time we talked about how to apply Cauchy's theorem, and in principle, we derive the residue theorem. And the residue theorem says that if you have some contour C, closed contour C, and inside the contour there are a number of singularities of your function, and outside there are other singularities, then the integral of your holomorphic function on the contour is given by 2 pi I, the sum of the residues of the function, so residues of the function at the singularities which lie inside the contour. And this is taken in the counterclockwise direction. If you do the integral in the clockwise direction, there would be a minus sign. So today we'll see how this theorem can be used to meromorphic functions to evaluate real integrals. And this is where the definition of meromorphic becomes relevant, because the trick that we'll use, that we will consider a contour where part of it goes through the real axis. And the part of the contour that lies on the imaginary, on the complex plane, away from the real axis, we'll take a limit where that goes off to infinity. And we'll see cases where the contribution from that part a lot of time vanishes. So having our integrand a meromorphic function is useful there, so that, you know, when we take the limit going to infinity, things don't kind of, you know, we have things under control.
What's the definition of meromorphic again?
Where the function has only poles on the finite part of the complex plane. So let's start with something nice and easy. Let's do a trigonometric integral. I mean, the Cauchy residue theorem is really a cheat for not doing an integral. So consider the integral. For a lot of you, this will be familiar. So just bear with me. By the end of this lecture, I'll get to a problem which will be a little bit harder than the others. So we want to do this integral where a is greater than b, and they're positive and real. So we want to evaluate a complex integral. So notice that if we can convert the cosine into some kind of polynomial of a complex variable, then we might get somewhere. So let's limit ourselves on the circle on a complex plane. So let z be e to the power I theta. If you limit ourselves to the contour, which is a circle centered around the origin, then this means that I can write cosine of theta as like so. Then our integral becomes like this. So this, of course, implies that d of z is related to d of theta in this way. So now we know that the integrand has poles wherever the denominator, which is a polynomial, has zeros. So the denominator, which is a polynomial, now this has zeros in these two places. Now since A is greater than B, and they're both positive and real, minus A by B is less than minus 1. So that means if I subtract a negative number from that.
Excuse me, Diva, I'm kind of confused with the polynomial. So it's like there are many B's and it's z squared.
Oh, yeah, sorry, right. Because 2, sorry, I wrote the wrong polynomial down. Sorry. Good that you're paying attention.
Plus B, just plus B.
Sorry. I don't know what happened. I must have been reading simultaneously from left and right. Happens to geniuses, you know? Overactive brains. Okay, so this thing is already outside the unit circle. So if you subtract a positive number from it, or you know, if you add a negative number to it, it gets even further from the unit circle. So the z minus root is outside the unit circle, but the z plus root is then inside the unit circle, because you can show very easily that this is 1. So in other words, the S squared is greater than, so yeah, in other words, there is one of the, it's probably not something like this, I think. Yeah, so what, so this is, if this is at minus, then this is at plus. So we have to consider the residue of our integrand at the point z plus. So let's do that. So the residue is we take the limit where z goes to z plus, we are multiplying by z minus z plus, and this is our integrand. So these two things cancel. After they cancel, I put z plus over here, and then I use the explicit, so I get minus 2i z plus minus z minus, and then I use the values of z plus and z minus here, and then I get minus ib a squared minus b squared. So according to the Cauchy's residue theorem, the integral is then 2 pi I times this minus IB So if you simplify this, you get 2 pi B So this is an example of a trigonometric integral with a circular contour. So next, we'll, very useful are semicircular contours. So before we go on to do an example, let me state an useful, a useful theorem on semicircular contour. Sorry, I'm not going to prove any of these theorems. You can find proofs in any complex analysis books. These are very basic proofs. And they, most of the time, they use some sort of triangle inequality or something like that, you know, some. All right, so suppose we have a holomorphic function, you know, such that the modulus of this function is bounded by something like this, where, so on a, you know, contour gamma, parametrized by r e to the power I theta. So the r here is the radius of the of the semicircle or the semicircular contour. So where theta is either between pi to zero or between pi and 2 pi. So it can be either in the upper half plane or the lower half plane, our contour. And k is positive and real. So this is k and m are real and positive. So, sorry, k is positive and greater than 1, and m is real and positive. So then the theorem is that the modulus of this integral over this kind of contour is bounded by this, and this guy goes to 0 as r goes to infinity. So basically, it's a technical way of saying that if your integrand has this kind of form for, say, large r, then you know its contribution to the semicircular contour vanishes. So let's look at an application. So an integral of this form, okay, let's not write I yet, is, so it's, okay, we are going to try to compute this integral. So this is on a positive real axis. So now note that this is an even function, the integrand. So we can write this as the half of the same of this integral, but with the limit now from minus infinity to plus infinity. So now, to evaluate this integral, we are going to consider, let me get a different colored chalk. We'll consider a contour which goes from minus r to plus r. Okay, so the contour goes like this and goes up like that. And the semicircular part is gamma. And the complex integral that we'll consider is this thing. So let's So this is a closed contour integral. So the real part of this integral is exactly this thing, right? So now this becomes a game of residues. According to Cauchy's residue theorem, you know, there are four residues at z equals to plus ia minus ia, yeah?
In order to choose the top semicircle over the bottom one, we need to, like,
you have to check whether this condition is satisfied for this guy or this guy.
Yeah.
In this case, it's satisfied for the upper half plane.
Okay.
Right.
And can you see that it's satisfied?
So if you convert this into polar coordinates and take large values of r, you know, you can kind of ignore a's and b's. Then you see in the denominator you have r to the power 4. And on the numerator you've got an r, so you've got 1 over r cubed. So the k over here would be 3 in that case. Yes, Barak?
But in this case you could have used the lower half.
Yes.
Oh.
In this case it doesn't matter. It didn't matter. But in other cases, you know, it could matter. So. In fact, we'll do some slightly different kind of examples where it does matter whether you use upper half or lower half. So, right, so as people pointed out, you could have closed this contour on the lower half plane, and it would have given you the same result. So, okay, so we have, poles at plus A minus plus IA minus IA plus IB minus IB, but the contour we have chosen, the poles that are relevant are at plus IA and plus IB, so here and here. And if you just, and these are actually simple poles, so they're easy to compute. So if you do the calculation, which I won't do, but I encourage you to do it, if you haven't done this sort of things before, you get two contributions. So half 2 pi I from Cauchy's residue theorem, and then you basically get from the first pole, okay, I'm just doing it anyway, limit z goes to plus I A. There is z plus ia, z squared plus b squared, and then the limit of z going to plus ib. So one of the factor, the z minus ia factor, is canceled by the z minus ia factor that I have to multiply it with. And in this case, if you now let A and B be same, you know, you actually get the same, you get the correct result. Or you could have used the formula for computing the residue for a higher order pole. Doesn't matter. It's another extremely, so a lot of times what you have is that you just don't have an integral here, a polynomial in the denominator. You also have some cosine and sine function. And to deal with that kind of stuff, you cannot use this theorem anymore. You actually have to use a different theorem, which goes by the name of Jordan's lemma.
To deal with what design?
So okay, sometimes you'll have cosines and sines here in the numerator, okay. And you know, to deal with those kind of integrals, you know, if you have a cosine of x or something like that, then that condition will not hold, because if you just, you know, replace x by r of e to the power I theta, you'll see that it's you know, it's a completely different beast. So you need a different theorem, and that's known as Jordan's lemma. So you know, it's weird. Like, you can't do like. There are some very simple integrals that you can't do using complex analysis. You know, the integral of the Gaussian, for the real Gaussian, for example. You know. I think you can do that one for the. Using the result for the real Gaussian, I think you can do the one for the imaginary one, right, or complex one. And we haven't done that for a while. So, but I think one of the other courses, in Dan's lecture, he will actually do that integral. So, all right. So Jordan's lemma states that, well, it's for evaluating integrals of this form. Omega is some constant. So the lemma is actually, so this is not the lemma. Lemma states that, so suppose gamma of R is a semicircular contour on the upper half plane centered around the origin, and let M of R be the maximum of the modulus of our holomorphic function on this contour. Now let omega be a real number that is greater than zero. And let the constant m, let the constant mr which bounds your function go to zero as r goes to infinity. So then Jordan's lemma states that the integral over this upper, this semicircular contour this goes to zero as r goes to infinity. Essentially, this guy goes to zero. So a consequence of Jordan's lemma is if you take this integral now, then it'll be given by 2 pi I summed over all the residues of that, of the, sorry. So the sum over the residues of your integrand on the upper half plane. And that's because it's the same logic as before. What we are saying is that the contribution from this part of the contour vanishes, so only this guy survives. But according to Cauchy's residue theorem, the whole integral is equal to 2 pi I times the sum of the residues of the function at the singularities inside. And this result follows from there. Now this also, if your original function was like, was not, integral was of this form, with omega positive, so now with a minus sign, and now all of this held except it held on the lower half plane, then you would get the same theorem tells you that that integral is given by the sum of the residues in the lower half plane. So here, omega, I'm assuming to be positive. So let's now see an example.
Can I ask a question about this part? So it says that if the two sides of the semicircle were taken to infinity in different ways, we'd get different results.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but what do you mean by taking infinity in different ways?
Right, a very good question. So this is the limit that we take is when we take R to infinity, right? But suppose that, you know, we had, okay, we call this R1 and R2. And we took, and suppose that R1 minus R2 was some, was not zero. So suppose this was not a semicircle, but you know, a little bit of a deformed semicircle. Or the center was not here, right?
Yeah.
Just slightly off or something. And if you took the limit where R1 and R2 went to infinity, but the remainder was the same, was held constant, then we would get a completely different result. We could actually get any result, I think, by, you know, if we did, we could get a, I don't know if it any result, any real number, but you know, a lot of different numbers if we chose to take these two limits to infinity in a different way. So the particular way of taking this to infinity is called, I think, Cauchy's principal value, or some other stuff. So you know, so that's kind of an important thing. But, don't ask me the deeper reason for that. I have never looked it up, but it's like, you know, I mean, there's stuff like, I think it's kind of analogous to, you know, when you sum divergent series, and you can actually kind of, you know, if you are allowed to kind of to rearrange the series as any way you like, you can actually get all kinds of different results for the same series. All right, example. So let's consider this the integral where we now have a sine of x in the numerator. So for this guy, notice that this would be the imaginary part of this integral. Right? So this tells us that we should consider, because you know this is still real, x is still real, that we should consider then the integral of this form. What am I doing? So this thing, when projected down to the real axis, gives us this, and then taking the imaginary part of this gives us this. So if we could find a contour where we do an integral with this integrand, say a contour, because that condition is satisfied if we do now the integral on that contour, then we see that part of that integral is the one along the real axis is this guy, and the part of the integral from the upper half plane, you know, will vanish when we take R to infinity. And then what we will do is that we'll take that, whatever result we get, we take the imaginary part of that, and that'll give us the answer. There's a real part, we don't care about that. Sometimes, and we'll see an example of this in today's tutorial, that the imaginary part gives you a nice integral, the real part gives you another, a different result to a different integral. So, you know, this is what we call in North America fancy. So, all right. So the poles, so you know, of this integrand are at uh, at these points. So you see that the residue that you have to compute is at z plus, because the z minus lies in the lower half plane. And if you do the, if you compute the residue and do the integral, this is the result you should get. So sometimes our integrand will have a pole on the real axis. And then, you know, then these theorems are not very useful because, you know, we have to deal with a contour which, you know, goes around or comes near a pole on the real axis, right? So for that case, there's a very nice and cute theorem called the mouse hole contour theorem. So for those cases, the mouse hole contour is useful. So let's consider mouse hole contours. And before we consider an explicit example, let me give you a result. So let's suppose that f of z has a simple pole at z equals 2a. So let me redraw this picture to suggest that it is A is some arbitrary point A on the real axis. Wait, actually, it doesn't even have to be at the real axis. OK, so this is A. Now consider the contour. Now, so consider the contour. Phi sub epsilon, which is centered around the point A. It's a semicircle, it's an arc, it's a segment of a circle of radius epsilon, where the T is the angle which goes from B to alpha. So let me bring that down and draw the picture, complete the picture. So our contour is something like this, where this angle, so this is just an angle, this is angle is alpha, and this angle is beta. Sorry, there's a typo in the picture, in the notes. In the picture, in the notes, I said beta is this angle, but it's actually the angle, you know, calculated from this direction. All right. So then the theorem is that in the limit where epsilon goes to 0, the integral of our function I forgot to mention, f of z has a simple pole at A with residue sigma. This is like multitasking between two different windows, right? So the theorem is, in the limit where the contour is shrinking, and the proof could not be easier. Although the proof is very easy, this is a technique that people use a lot when doing contour integrals. And the idea is that, well, f has a pole at, or singularity at z equals to a, but poles are easy to deal with. You just define a new function which doesn't have that pole. So we essentially tease out the pole part with its residue. Then g does not have a pole at z equals to a, right? Because the pole part with its residue is contained here. And then if you now do this integral, because g is holomorphic at z equals to a, by continuity, when you take the contour to 0, the contribution from g goes to 0. And here, this sigma is a constant, and you're doing an integral over 1 over z, essentially, but not from 0 to 2 pi anymore. You're doing the integral from, you know, alpha to beta, and that's how you get beta minus alpha. Times, you know, yeah, so times I. OK?
And what is a higher order?
Sorry?
Pole?
If there are higher order poles, you have to be a bit more clever. In fact, our example has exactly that. So you can still use this theorem in certain cases. I mean, these theorems are, I mean, I don't know, somehow complex analysis is kind of a Baroque art. It's not really, I don't know, it doesn't seem like there are some theorems that cover an extremely wide range of, you know, cases. So a lot of times you actually have to be very clever, you know, do some very, you know, clever manipulations like Bach, and then you have it thing set up, you know. So okay, so our example. So the example we're going to consider is do this integral and as you can see the pole at the origin has order 3. So obviously we can't use our mouse hole contour theorem, yeah?
I just have a question still about the mouse hole result. So if you put in, say, beta is 2 pi and alpha is 0, right, then it's like doing the real, trying to do like the real integral, and you get 2 pi I times the residue, which is the same as if you did like the contour.
No, you're doing exactly that.
So,
yeah. Sorry.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry. Pi. So,
if,
is there a result where we should?
Sorry, if beta is what
so,
are you
sorry,
taking?
Pi. Yeah. So, well, beta
is pi.
Beta is pi, and say so, and alpha is 0. So you're like trying to do the.
Then you would get pi there, right? Pi.
Yeah, so that is like, that's the same result as if you just like said, okay, I'm going to ask half this, like it's only the semicircle part.
Yeah.
So, I mean, why didn't we just like think of it that way? Why don't we just say like we don't need to like integrate over this huge semicircle, we just like integrate over.
Oh, right, right. So,
you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, in all the previous examples, what we saw is that we took the size of the semicircle to infinity, right? But here, what we are doing is that we are actually taking the semicircle or part of the circle to zero.
Like there's two arcs. One arc goes to infinity. And one
right.
Goes
yeah.
To
infinity. So, you know, we actually never have considered before of an arc or a semicircle shrinking down to zero size, right? And this mouse hole contour theorem lets us deal with those kind of situation.
Yeah, I'm just asking like why, we already knew this result because we know
I
that
didn't.
Integrating around a point, you get 2πi times the residue.
Yeah, we know that.
So like.
Right. Yeah, of course.
Is that the same thing?
It.
Basically, right? Because if you shrink the mouse hole, then like there should be like the variation or whatever of the.
I'm not exactly sure. You know, so you're saying that, you know, what if I take 2π here and beta equals to zero?
Sorry, pi and or zero and pi. So,
yeah.
Or whatever, right?
Right. So you're doing something like this, right?
Like, it seems like what the result is that we use the fact that we already knew that if you just go all the way around, it's 2πi times the residue.
Right.
And then it seems like you just take whatever, like if you go around a quarter of the circle, then it's a quarter of the value of 2πi times the residue.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. I'm not. There are other things that we're using here, right? And such as, you know, there is that sigma has that the function gf has a residue sigma at that point, right? So, you know, that's something that we're using implicitly. But, you know, so okay, what I'm saying is that there's nothing deep here, absolutely nothing deep here. I'm just pointing out something that is very useful.
Okay.
So, you know, this is one line, right? And there's absolutely nothing deep here. But all I'm saying is that this is a useful observation, you know. And when you have a useful observation, even if it's very simple and you're going to use it a lot of times, it's good to give it a name, right? So maybe call it a lemma, not a theorem, you know, if you think that that's doesn't.
Yeah.
So, I want to.
It's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think that it's weird that someone could also just guess that you just say like take whatever fraction of the value of 2πi times the residue that we're going around, you know, because you would think
right,
that
right.
It's not
yeah,
like
yeah.
Isotropic.
Sure,
like,
yeah,
the function
yeah.
can vary with like the angle.
Right,
so
yeah.
I just thought that was kind of weird.
But I think that the important thing here is that it's a simple poll because the other result that is the whole circle is 2πi residue.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, you can use it for a function that have higher order pole,
right.
But this like isotropic distribution of the angle
of the value
maybe
of the angle
it's,
along that
it's because it has a simple pole. I mean, there's
maybe
a difference.
I guess. I don't know. Anyways.
Right. So I guess, you know, if this was not a simple pole, so if there was like, you know, kind of a square of this, you know, I guess that it would be a different result, right? So
yeah. Okay.
So. So all right. So this guy is clearly doesn't satisfy our condition. So one good thing about it is that it is a the integrand is an even function, so. We can write it like this. Okay. Now if we consider f of z, which is I of z minus e to the power I of z times z cubed, then you see that the imaginary part, so suppose this is, the imaginary part of f, you know, when projected down to the real line, coincides with this. So if you take the imaginary, so here we have got x plus iy. So the ix part is contributes to the imaginary part. Here there's the sign. And then you've got sine of z and I cosine of z, but when you take the value of z to x, that is you're projecting it down to the imaginary axis, then this thing coincides with this.
Just ask about when you say that it's a triple pill? Is the Taylor expansion of sine of x like x minus, or is the Taylor expansion of sine of x valid in the complex plane as well, the usual one you have with the reals?
Right. So yes. So okay, what you're saying is that okay. It's actually not a triple pull. It's actually, so if I expand this out, then I get the x. Yeah, so the x part, goes away, and then the next thing we get is then we get x cubed.
I guess I'm just asking if that is indeed a simple pull.
Right. No. Hang on. What you're saying is, so if I have x minus, so this will cancel out, right?
Yeah.
And then you will have x cubed by 3 factorial, and then we have x cubed. And, I see. Yeah, okay.
Right. Is that what the Laurent series would look like for that function?
Right, and then if you go higher, then what you have is, right, so.
Here you're in the reals.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So you're right. This thing doesn't, but this thing does. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, this thing doesn't, but sorry. Yeah, this thing does. So if you just expand this, then you have I of z, and then we have 1 minus I of z plus z squared by factorial of 2. And you're right. So for example, this guy wasn't there in this formula, right? So here, you will get 1 over these two things will cancel. But this guy will give you 1 over z cubed, and that is a triple pull. So yeah, sorry. Yeah?
Just a point. So I don't think that the imaginary part of this new function is actually the function above. Because yes, in the denominator.
No, not the imaginary part. The imaginary part when evaluated on the real line.
Oh, on the real.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Sorry. Okay. So sorry about that. This is not the one which has a triple pull. But we are going to do a complex integral, and I'm claiming that if we try to find the most simple-minded complex version of this guy, then that thing will have a triple pole at the origin. Okay, so, thank you very much, And so then what we do is that we just may do exactly the same kind of trick that we did here, except we're going to separate out the triple pole. So we define another function, h of z, which is our original function, complex function, with the triple pole part subtracted. This is just so you can now see that when we project, when we look at the imaginary part of H and project it down to the real line, then we actually haven't changed the function. So the part that we have added, you know, does not affect, you know, so the imaginary part of H projected down onto the real line and the imaginary part of F projected down to the real line are the same. So if we now do the integral with this function, then, you know, at the end, and if we can make sure that, you know, contribution from all the other parts go to zero or something, then, you know, we can actually evaluate the integral that we wanted to evaluate. So now what we do is that we take our, we integrate h over the following contour, where gamma is, we go from minus r to minus small r, and let's call this part of the contour C1, and there's a little semicircle. Let's call that C3, and then we go from plus small r to plus big R, which has C2. So we go like this. And then we close our contour on the upper half plane like that. Okay. So by subtracting this guy, what we have done is that the leading singularity now comes from this term, right? And which is a simple pole. Well, the only singularity. And therefore, we can actually use our theorem for the mouse hole contour. And then in the limit where we let, you know, the radius, the small r, go to zero, the contribution from this part vanishes. And we also let big R go to infinity. And by the previous theorems, you know, this part will also go to zero. And then what we see is that what we're left with is from minus infinity to zero, zero to plus infinity. And so if you do this now, it's only the C1 part and the C2 part which are non-vanishing. Sorry, that's not true. Why didn't anyone stop me? This doesn't go to zero. This is given by this result, this theorem now. Right. Right. So because there are no, because this guy doesn't have any poles inside this contour, because the pole is actually outside over here, this is what we get. So, and this integral has now four parts, C1, C2, C3, C4. The C4 vanishes. So the contribution from the C1 plus C2 is equal to the contribution from C3. And C3 is given by using our mouse hole contour theorem. This. Right. And there's an additional minus sign which comes here, because in our original theorem, the contour went in the counterclockwise direction, but here this contour goes in the clockwise direction. Okay. And when we use this, when you have used all of this, you find 0 to infinity x minus sine of x, x cubed, d of x is pi by 4. Okay. So anyway.
Sorry.
Yeah?
We are using the Mouse-Hole theorem, assuming that there's no pole in the first part of our H function, so in the first term. But isn't there still a single pole with the...
So F had a third order pole at the origin, but we subtracted that, right?
Yeah, but we also got the term z squared over.
Right.
Z.
Yeah, but that's a pole at the origin.
Oh, yeah, true.
So it's outside the contour. It's outside the closed contour. Yeah. Okay.
The solution you answer for when you integrate h is that when we add it on 1 over z cubed?
Sorry?
So we integrated h is that, right?
Right.
So how did we relate that back to the integral of f is that?
Right. So if you look at the h, let's bring this down. So, right. So the idea is that, you know, how did we define H and how did that relate to this guy? And the idea is that if you project this down to the real axis, so you just put X's wherever Z's are.
Oh, that's not changing the imaginary.
And that's not changing the imaginary part, because this is just changing the real part, okay? And, you know, we are just taking the imaginary part of this, so.
So if you have like a mouse hole and you take the limit of the small r to zero in different ways, like the then it shouldn't change the result, right?
Here we are just taking the radius to zero. Although I said minus r and plus r are going to zero.
It's like the report, but in just a general.
Yeah, there we are just taking the radius to zero. So, you know, it's just, we are not deforming. So what you're saying is that does it matter if what way we take the if you deform
like
the semi the part the you know the part of the circle you know arc arc is the right word you know segment if you deform the segment away from the circle but at the end of the day I don't think it probably would not matter but you know if you do something wild if it kind of goes then it might and like but I don't I think if it kind of remains kind of smooth, then it should be okay, but I have to think about it. All right, in the last 7 minutes, we are going to do the most difficult and fancy example. And I'm going to use the cut plane now. And in today's tutorial, there would be a variation of this problem where you actually have to be a bit clever and use your gray cells. So now the last part is integrals involving logarithms. So sometimes if you have some holomorphic function which has no singularities, along the positive real axis, we can evaluate this integral by doing an integral of this form. Where C is a mouse hole contour, that C has this form. Sorry, not a mouse hole, a keyhole contour. So, right. So this is supposed to be a circle, well, an almost circle with radius R. This is supposed to be a small circle with radius small r. And let's call this C1. And this is C2. This is C3, C4. And how does this work? So if you now consider the integrals along C2 and C4, and imagine that C1 and C2 and C4 are very, very, very close to, that it's approaching the real line, then the integral from along C4, which then would go from 0 to infinity, but then the integral around along C2, when it would go from my, it would actually go from plus infinity to zero, to zero. So it'll go from, but over there, the log would actually have, because the log is multi, you know, is not a single valued function, it'll have this form. And now if you change the limit, you know, these two guys will cancel out, leaving you with the value of the integral. So this is the trick that we're going to use. So we are now going to assume and that our function is such that in the limit where big R goes to infinity, so when big R goes to infinity, the contribution from C1 goes to zero, as well as when small r goes to zero, the contribution from C3 goes to zero. So you have to actually check that these conditions are satisfied to be able to do this integral. So if this is so, then you know this implies that the integral of f of x d of x will be given by minus the sum of the residues of f of z log of z inside the, you know, the whole, this whole contour. Okay, I have 1 minute. Maybe I can go over a couple of minutes where I'll just do very quickly sketch out an example. And the details are in the notes. The part about computing the residues is a little tricky. And but it has nothing to do with using this theorem, so, or using this the logarithmic application of this result. So that's not essential. So let's consider this guy. Now the denominator has zeros at e to the power I pi by 3, e to the power I pi, and e to the power I 5 pi by 3, where this is just minus 1. So according to this theorem, we want to look at the residues of this function. Now because the poles of our original integral, you know, lie on the, and also this integral, you know, lie on a circle, we actually have to compute the residues of this function at these points on the unit circle. But on the unit circle, log of z is nothing but the argument of z. And using the theorem that we the result that we had for computing the residues for rational functions, the residue of this guy turns out to be I arg of z by 3 z squared. So this is just a trick for computing the residues of this function. And this is kind of an aside from application of this result. So by using this trick, you can now just, you know, evaluate the residues by taking the value of z to be these things. And they are all inside that contour. So you actually sum them up, and you apply this theorem, and you get the result, which is 2 pi over 3 square root of 3. OK, so sorry for rushing through that. But this is an example of the application of the keyhole contour. And I'm done. Thanks for your attention.